Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, Los Angeles school workers go on strike for better wages and working conditions, shuttering classes for more than 400,000 students.
New video shows multiple sheriff's deputies forcibly pinning down a man at a Virginia mental hospital, leading to his death. We speak with the man's family.
And 20 years later, Iraqis reflect on how the United States invasion and its aftermath changed their lives.
We thought the Americans will come, that they'll free us from Saddam, that finally we'll get our rights, but we haven't seen any benefit.
Good evening and welcome to the NewsHour. It's been a day of dueling diplomacy in Russia and Ukraine. At the Kremlin, China's President Xi Jinping met with Russian President Vladimir Putin for a second day as the two nations appeared to strengthen ties.
The state visit by the Chinese leader featured all the ceremony and trappings that Moscow could muster. Xi and Putin attended a lavish ceremony and presented a united front against the West. Later, Putin talked up China's 12-point peace proposal for Ukraine.
We believe many points of China's peace plan are in sync with Russian approaches and could form a basis for a peaceful settlement when the West and Kyiv are ready for it. But so far, we see no such readiness on their side.
Putin accused Western powers of prolonging the war, saying, quote, the West intends to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian.
Meanwhile, Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida made a surprise visit to Kyiv, meeting with President Zelensky and offering what he called unwavering support for Ukraine. His trip also included laying flowers at the site of a massacre in Bucha. The town outside the capital has become a symbol of Russian atrocities. Russia's military appeared to respond by flying two strategic bombers over the Sea of Japan for more than 7 hours. The U.S. is playing down plans for Taiwan's president to stop in the U.S. during an upcoming visit to Central America. Tsai Ing-wen will transit through New York and Los Angeles, but mainland China is already condemning the plan. At the White House today, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said, in effect, it's much ado about nothing.
There's no reason for China to overreact. Heck, there's no reason for them to react. I mean, this is something that is commonplace and has happened before, will likely happen again. It's personal, it's unofficial. There should be no reason for Beijing to react in any way to this.
During her stopovers, Tsai is expected to hold unofficial meetings with U.S. officials and lawmakers. In Haiti, U.N. officials say rampant gang violence killed at least 187 people from late February into early March. More than 150 others were hurt. Video out today showed people fleeing their homes in the capital of Port-au-Prince on Monday. Farmers have also had to abandon their fields. Gangs have increasingly taken over Haiti since the president was assassinated in 2021. Back in this country, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says the turmoil in banking is stabilizing, but that regulators will do more to guarantee bank deposits if need be. They've covered all deposits for Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, eclipsing the previous $250,000 limit. In Washington, Yellen told the American Bankers Association that it's critical to ensure public confidence.
Our intervention was necessary to protect the broader U.S. banking system. And similar actions could be warranted if smaller institutions suffered deposit runs that posed the risk of contagion.
Also today, leaders of the nation's major banks began a two-day regularly scheduled meeting in Washington. They're expected to discuss their $30 billion rescue of First Republic Bank based in San Francisco. On Wall Street, Yellen's comments helped lower tensions and boost stocks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 316 points, or 1%, to close at 32,560. The Nasdaq rose 1.5%. The S&P 500 added 1.3%. The basketball world is in mourning tonight for NBA Hall of Famer Willis Reed. He led the New York Knicks to their first title in 1970, playing injured in Game 7 to beat the Los Angeles Lakers. Today, the Knicks tweeted the iconic image of Reed walking out onto the court moments before tip-off for that game. He won another title in 1973 and was also a seven-time All-Star. Willis Reed was 80 years old. And the White House hosted some of the nation's leading musicians, actors, and writers today. President Biden presented Bruce Springsteen with the National Medal of the Arts. He also honored Julia Louis-Dreyfus and fellow actor Mindy Kaling, among others. And National Humanities Medals went to 10 writers, historians, and more.
The work of our honorees is as diverse as the nation that celebrates with them today. But common threads weave them together in many ways, in the very fabric of America. The pursuit of excellence, the drive to create, the yearning to connect, and the boldness to be truth-tellers, bridge-builders, and change-seekers.
The honors were actually for 2021, but had been delayed by the pandemic. And there's lots more about the medal recipients on our website. That's pbs.org/newshour. Still to come on the NewsHour, the U.S. and South Korea hold military exercises while the North ramps up missile testing. The outgoing director of the World Food Program on how to address growing global hunger. Actor Randall Park discusses his directorial debut and Asian American representation in Hollywood, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
A massive strike has shut down schools today in the Los Angeles Unified School District, and it's focused on higher wages and better working conditions. This school strike was not initiated by the teachers, who were still under contract, but by some of the district's lowest paid employees.
Class was canceled in the nation's second largest school district.
UPLA!
School support staff took to the picket lines in the LA rain to demand higher wages and better staffing.
Today, thousands of SEIU Local 99 members are on strike, from the bus yards to the school yards to the kitchens and warehouses.
The union SEIU Local 99 represents custodians, bus drivers, special education assistants, and other essential school workers. Many of them live below the poverty line on account of low wages and limited work hours, made worse by inflation and LA's high cost of living. That's why they say they're pushing for a 30% salary increase, along with an additional $2 per hour for the district's lowest paid workers.
What do we want?
Justice!
Now!
Demonstrations started at a bus yard at 4:30 this morning, around the same time bus drivers would typically report to work. Tens of thousands of the district's school workers have now walked off the job. They have the backing of parents like Jenna Schwartz.
We have some of our most underpaid workers doing some of the most challenging jobs on our campuses. The majority aren't receiving health care. They've been negotiating for years.
The district offered a 20% wage increase over a multi-year period, along with a 3% bonus and expanded health benefits. Its superintendent accused the union of refusing to negotiate.
Despite our invitation for a transparent, honest conversation that perhaps would result in a meaningful solution that would avoid a strike, we were never able to be in the same room or at the same table to address these issues.
The onus is on this district!
Union leaders and many teachers support the strike, calling out the school district for ignoring workers' demands.
Superintendent Alberto Carvalho, give respect to the education workers that keep our schools running and our children safe.
The walkout is affecting some 420,000 students, disrupting not just class, but meals, counseling, and other social services.
I think it's not that good that we're having a strike because, like, it shuts down school for a few days, which, like, prohibits some people from learning.
The strike is expected to last for 3 days.
For students that are in need of food assistance, the district has set up 24 locations throughout Los Angeles County where students and families can grab breakfast and lunch. For the latest on the strike and the impact, I'm joined by Sequoia Carrillo, who covers education for NPR. She joins us from Los Angeles. Thanks for being with us. And Sequoia, the union says that the average salary of its members in the district is $25,000 a year, with many of these employees who are now on strike, many of them have worked part-time. You've been speaking with them today. What did they tell you about how these demands, if they're met, how it would improve their lives?
So many people that I talked to today had truly heartbreaking stories about working for the district and the sacrifices that they've had to go through, working multiple jobs, some going in and out of homelessness, being evicted from apartments, just due to the fact that there's an on season and an off season for a lot of this employment. And rent doesn't work like that. So if you're working part-time, you're working during the school year, you don't get that summer vacation. You don't get paid during that time for a lot of these positions, or some are even working far less hours than that. But they love what they do. These are school bus drivers. These are special education assistants in some instances. These are people that are really passionate about what they do, and they want to keep doing what they're doing. But at this level, they can't sustain themselves.
So the union is demanding a 30% increase in base salary over 4 years. The district has agreed to a 23% raise over 5 years, along with bonuses. Why is what the school district is proposing, why isn't that sufficient for the union?
The union here really, from what I can understand from talking to union members and union leadership, they really see their demands as almost the bare minimum. They feel like they've been arguing and negotiating over this contract for years at this point. And with inflation and with the economic downturn kind of looming, they really don't see much wiggle room. They also have had a kind of tenuous relationship with the district in negotiations recently. And I think this strike is their last straw. They don't want to budge on their position.
Sequoia, a three-day strike creates a real hardship for working parents. As we mentioned, many kids rely on school for meals and for social services. The superintendent told us today that 75% of kids in the LA school district are at or below the poverty line. So tell us more about how the neediest students, how they are going to be accommodated.
Absolutely. This is something that when I spoke with Superintendent Carvalho yesterday, he was very passionate about trying to lessen the impact as much as possible on those students that he's worried about. The district itself has set up different accommodations for these students. Some schools are open as kind of safe centers for students to go and do take-home packets that the district has sent out. Others are serving bagged meals to families, no questions asked. Whoever walks up and wants something, they will get a meal. There's also some limited childcare available, although I've been told by some parents that that has been very hard to get on the waiting list. We've also been seeing a lot of students at the picket lines, at these rallies. A lot of the workers in SIEU Local 99, the union, they are parents of students in LAUSD, and they brought their students with them to protest these working conditions.
Is there any reason to think, based on your reporting, that a three-day strike will be the thing that forces the school district's hand in these negotiations?
It's really hard to tell at this point. I really thought yesterday that there might be some resolution, and then that very quickly devolved late last night. I'm not sure if a three-day strike will be what it takes or not, but what I do know is that talking with leadership on both sides, there's a lot of people who want this to be over, who know how much this is taking a toll on the city and on parents and on workers and on students. And hopefully a resolution can be reached by the end of this.
Sequoia Carrillo covers education for NPR. Sequoia, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you for having me.
New video out from a mental hospital in Virginia today shows the overpowering use of force that led to the death of a 28-year-old patient earlier this month. A grand jury today indicted 10 people on second-degree murder charges in connection to the man's death. William Brangham has the details of this disturbing case. And a warning, we will show a short excerpt of that video, which may be hard to watch for some viewers.
2 weeks ago, sheriff's deputies transferred Ivo Otieno from a local jail to a state psychiatric hospital near Richmond. Otieno, who, according to his family, had struggled with mental health issues for years, was reportedly having a mental health crisis at the time of his arrest, following a burglary call. Silent hospital video captures the final minutes of his life. Multiple deputies and hospital staff are seen pressing Otieno down. His hands and feet were both cuffed, but law enforcement alleges he was acting aggressively. After almost 11 minutes, he loses consciousness and hospital staff try to revive him, but he never recovers. Seven deputies and three hospital employees have been indicted on second-degree murder charges. Attorneys for at least two of the deputies have maintained they are innocent, and attorneys for some other defendants said the release of the video could prejudice potential jurors. Otieno's family is being represented by civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump, who joins us now, along with Ivo's mother, Caroline Ouko. Thank you both so much for being here. Ms. Ouko, I am so sorry for what happened to your son, and we are so grateful that you've taken the time to speak with us about this. Before we talk about what happened to your son, can you just tell us a little bit about him?
He was my baby. He was my baby. He was a smart young man, and he grew up here in Richmond, went to school locally here in Richmond. He went to Tuckahoe Elementary School, into Tuckahoe Middle, and then Freeman High School. And then eventually he went to college in California. Ivo has a way. He was not quick to anger. He took his time. He was like his father. He loved people. He was the peacemaker in our family. If there was a matter, he would always come in and ask us to look at it a different way as well. He always brought a different perspective to the table. He was a good listener. He loved his family. He loved me so much, and I loved him that much.
Other family members have described a long struggle that your son had with mental illness. Do you have any sense of how he was on the day that he was arrested initially or transferred to the hospital?
On the day that he was arrested, Ivo was coherent. We were in the house. You could talk to him, he could answer you back. And even when they left with him to take him to the hospital, he was talking and asking questions. That's, you know, he had it. He was not fully gone, that he was not aware of surrounding, aware of himself.
The mental distress.
He was just in mental distress.
Mr. Crump, the prosecutor alleges that 10 of those people that we saw on that hospital video are guilty of second-degree murder. Do you believe that that is the appropriate severity of these charges?
When you watch the video and you see a young man who is restrained in handcuffs and leg irons, and he's face down, and they all pile on him, you see people put knees on his neck 3 years after George Floyd, you have to scratch your head and say, why in the world would you use that kind of excessive force for not 1 minute, but over 11 minutes? They literally smothered him to death. This is not a young man who was committing a crime. He was having a mental health crisis. Why is it when black people have mental health issues, they aren't treated as medical issues. They're treated as criminal issues. And far too often, they result into the death sentence.
Ms. Ouko, do you feel like justice is being properly pursued here?
Yes, we are in the right step. And this group, this gang of thugs, criminals, murderers, will, you know, they will answer for the heinous crime. They had no reason doing that to my son. My son was not a threat. But they went ahead and smothered the life out of him.
Mr. Crump, the prosecutor alleges that other video taken in the jail shows Ivo being punched and pepper sprayed. This was prior to getting to the hospital. Have you seen that video? Is that something that you are also pursuing?
We saw that video, and we think that it was reprehensible how they treated this young man who was having a mental health crisis. Remember, his mother, when they first came to their home, she hugged him and she told them, he's in mental distress. He's not a bad person. So why treat him like a criminal? Why not have humanity for him? And that's what we are struggling to deal with. I know President Biden had the cast of Ted Lasso at the White House talking about the importance of mental health. Well, we hope that they're able to engage when Black people have mental health issues, that they will treat issues affecting our loved ones like medical issues and not criminal issues, because that is what we see. No matter how many times, like Ms. Caroline said, he's having a mental health crisis, they still tend to be tone deaf. Mm-hmm. And we have to do something about that, America.
Ms. Ouko, Virginia's Governor Glenn Youngkin was asked about your son's death, and he indicated that we as a society have to figure out a better way how to deal with people who are in mental crisis, as it so clearly sounds like your son was. What is it that you hope people, our society, might learn from your family's tragedy?
I hope that really and truly they can, put some changes in the mental health system and have a mobile response team that when you call for help, you know, you get the right trained personnel to come to you, you know, to help you with your loved one. And meanwhile, I'm seeking justice for my son. I want anyone else that was involved in the mistreatment of my son or who played a part in his murder, I want them to be found and brought to justice.
And we don't want this to happen to anybody else.
Yes.
In America struggling with mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
It was Ivo this time. If we don't change the system, it could be your loved one.
All right, Benjamin Crump and Caroline Ouko, thank you so much. And again, our condolences for what you are all going through. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Tensions on the Korean Peninsula are running high. This month, the U.S. and South Korea launched their largest military exercises in nearly 6 years. And in response, North Korea tested 5 missiles, part of a record number of tests over the last 15 months. Nick Schifrin looks at the debate over U.S. policy in the region as the exercises and tests continue.
Above the Korean Peninsula, a show of force. U.S. bombers fly alongside South Korean jets to increase what the U.S. military called wartime strategic strike capabilities. And near the North Korean border, American and South Korean troops fire together as part of 11-day-long exercises they call Freedom Shield and Warrior Shield.
Majority of the training that we've conducted today is always to ensure that we're ready to fight tonight.
But North Korea also tried to show it's ready to fight. Last week on state TV, it tested an intercontinental ballistic missile it says can reach the entire continental U.S. It was a family affair. That's North Korean leader Kim Jong-un with his daughter and with his sister on the right alongside senior officials. In the last week, North Korea also launched what it called a simulation of a nuclear attack on South Korea after Kim reduced the threshold for preemptive strikes. And it launched a missile from a submarine, just one of more than 115 tests in the last year, the most in North Korean history.
They have a mission to qualitatively and quantitatively advance their nuclear missile program. They are using military exercises as a pretext, as an excuse. When you look at the past history, they've always conducted these kind of missile tests during the exercises.
Sumi Terry is the director of the Asia program at the Wilson Center in Washington. She says Kim Jong-un has no interest in diplomacy until the U.S. accepts North Korea as a nuclear weapons power.
They themselves said so last fall when they said, we're not coming back to talks if we are talking about denuclearization. We'll come back to the talks potentially to talk about arms control or something else, but it's not going to be about denuclearization.
But other North Korea experts believe Kim is willing to adjust his swagger if the U.S. were willing to adjust exercises and sanctions.
They're unhappy with our military exercises, and they may in fact be unhappy with the failure of the United States to meet the kinds of expectations they have about starting diplomatic activity.
Ambassador Robert Gallucci is a Georgetown professor and former diplomat. In the 90s, he was the chief U.S. negotiator of an agreement in which North Korea promised to shut down its nuclear weapons complex in exchange for energy facilities and improved relations. That eventually failed, as did diplomatic efforts under President Obama.
I think that your country has tremendous.
And President Trump's direct talks with Kim Jong-un. Unlimited. Now, the Biden administration has increased military exercises and regional cooperation, but also offered North Korea to meet anywhere with no preconditions.
Does that strategy make sense, do you think?
Well, it would make sense if it was working, and it doesn't make sense since it's not. That's better than having preconditions, but it's not as good as saying, look, we've thought about this, and we're prepared to make some moves, and we are going to begin with the fact that we have sanctions, which we can manipulate. We have military exercises, which we can manipulate. And we're prepared to send you a nice positive signal here that we're prepared to make some serious changes.
Should the U.S. be willing to adjust its exercises and its sanctions in order to get North Korea to the diplomatic table?
I don't think so. North Koreans are not interested in returning to the talks right now. Kim Jong-un has made up his mind to get his technical capability to a next level before they return to talks.
North Korea's nuclear advances have increased anxiety across the border in South Korea, where President Yoon Suk-yeol and other senior officials have discussed Seoul building its own nuclear arsenal. Oh Se-hoon is an influential member of President Yoon's party and a likely presidential candidate in 2027.
We've come to a point where it is difficult to convince people of the rationale that we should refrain from developing nuclear weapons and stick to the cause of denuclearization.
I think South Koreans are scared. They can trust the Biden administration, but to be honest, in the future, they're concerned about what's going to happen in the United States. Will we have another isolationist president who might talk about pulling troops out of South Korea?
But right now, the alliance is becoming more unified. For years, South Korea and Japan had difficult relations, but last week, their leaders resumed ties to help create a free and open Indo-Pacific.
We have agreed that under the current strategic environment, strengthening the Japan-South Korea relationship is an urgent task.
South Korea and Japan share the universal values of freedom, human rights, and law, and we are the closest neighbors and partners and must cooperate on security, economic issues, and global agendas.
An agenda that publicly includes countering North Korea's growing missile threat.
North Koreans are making all kinds of threats about preemptive use of nuclear weapons. But if they know that United States and South Korea and Japan are closely aligned and you cannot separate these countries, I think it will have some sort of impact.
North Korea continues to pose one of the U.S.'s most difficult challenges. And right now, the Biden administration is not signaling any policy change as the tests and exercises are expected to continue. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
The causes of global hunger are many and well known. Conflict, climate, and in too many cases, cruelty. But it is the job of the United Nations World Food Program to push through those barriers to feed hundreds of millions of people in need. Its executive director the last 6 years is David Beasley, under whose leadership the WFP won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2020. He leaves the post early next month. David Beasley joins us now, and welcome back to the NewsHour. It's always good to see you.
I'm always good to see you. Thank you very much.
As you well know, in your time at the helm at WFP, you have visited dozens of countries. You have seen firsthand as the global hunger crisis has only worsened in the Horn of Africa. We now know millions of people are facing famine. Years of war and the U.S. departure from Afghanistan have led to widespread hunger there. The war in Ukraine has further fueled all of this. Is it fair to say there is more work for the agency to do in more places now than when you began?
When I took this role 6 years ago, there were 80 million people marching towards starvation. And I literally thought that we could put the World Food Program out of business because we could end severe food insecurity around the world. Unfortunately, because of conflict after conflict, climate shocks, COVID economic disruption, Ukraine, and the list goes on, it's only getting worse and worse. And now we're reaching over 160 million people on any given day, week, and month. And that number of 80 million is now 345 million people marching towards starvation. And it's going to get worse because of food inflation, devaluation of the currency, and I could go on and on. The next 12 months are really going to be tough on the entire planet. 8 billion people are going to be struggling if we don't resolve some of these issues now.
As you prepare to leave this post, folks have been looking back at your time at the helm, and some have called you the money magnet because the WFP raised $6 billion in the year that you took office. Last year, that had more than doubled to over $14 billion. Over your 6 years, they've raised a total of $55 billion. That is astonishing. So how did you do it?
Well, you know, you see Democrats and Republicans in the United States, for example, fighting over everything. But when it comes to food security, it's like the miracle on Pennsylvania Avenue. On both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, the Republicans and Democrats have come together because they understand the significance of bringing peace through food security around the world. And quite frankly, had we not spent that money, I can assure you that the cost would have been 1,000 times more because of not just starvation, but mass migration that would have resulted and destabilization of nations. So it's money well spent to bring people hope in times of hopelessness. And so we can't back down now. Otherwise, you'll pay a lot more.
That's money from lawmakers and governments. You've also been publicly calling for more of the world's richest people, individuals, to step up and do, as you say, you know, what they have the power and the means to do. You specifically even called out Elon Musk and said, I can help you spend that money. You can end world hunger. I have to ask you, as you're preparing to step away, you've spoken to many of these people face to face. What is it that you think is keeping them from acting in this way?
I think it's several things. I do think the problems that we're facing around the world are quite extraordinary. But as I tell them, look, there's $400 trillion worth of wealth around the planet today. And your charity is not the long-term solution, but we are in a crisis mode right now and we need your help. But number two, I need your engagement. Work with us to end hunger around the world. You're putting rockets in space. You've got Apple phones and iPhones and technology that's doing all these remarkable things now. Let's use that ingenuity so that we end starvation and hunger around the planet. Engage. That's what I want you to do, because working together, we can solve this problem. And you know, when you got $400 trillion worth of wealth on the planet, and the fact that anyone dies from hunger, a child, shame on us. We can do better than this.
Cindy McCain, the current U.S. ambassador to U.N. agencies in Rome, and of course the widow of the late Senator John McCain, will be taking over for you. What is one thing you wish you'd known when you began that you've been able to offer her in the way of advice or guidance?
Well, it's a heck of a commitment. It really is. This is not a 9-to-5 job. It's 7 days a week. And Cindy and I have been working together tirelessly already. Our transition teams are working together. So she hits the ground running. There was so much that I didn't know. And she comes in and actually knowing a lot more than I did when I came in. And so I have no doubt that she'll be able to take the reins and move the operation forward in a way that's needed. I did what I needed to do for the 6 years. And I have no doubt she's the right person at the right time. At a time like this. And she has the capacity to bring Democrats and Republicans together in the United States. And, you know, we also get great support from Canada and other nations in the neighborhood, so to speak. So she'll be tested in a lot of ways, but I have no doubt she'll be able to do it. As I've told her, stay focused. Don't let the noise distract you. Stay focused on what the poorest of the poor and the vulnerable people need, and that will be a victory.
David, I've got less than a minute left, but I have to ask, your background was in politics before you took this job. You were, of course, South Carolina's governor in the 90s. Do you see yourself going back into public office?
Well, I've got 2 more weeks in this job. I'm going to stay focused on doing that, and I'm looking forward to going home. I've got now 3 grandchildren that I've really not spent any time with in the last couple of years, so I'm looking forward to spending some time, and we'll see what happens from there.
We'll see what happens indeed. In the meantime, David Beasley, the outgoing executive director of the World Food Program, thank you for joining us. Always good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
In Iraq, it's hard to find a town, a neighborhood, a street, or a family that hasn't been touched by the U.S. invasion 20 years ago and its turbulent aftermath. But some parts of the country suffered especially hard under the repeated waves of violence, loss, and trauma. Special correspondent Simona Fultine tells the story of the last 2 decades through the eyes and memories of 2 families.
20 years later, Zahi Karim still recalls his first encounter with American troops like it was yesterday.
The Americans came and they wanted to buy something from my shop. I refused to deal with them. They attacked me and hit me here. More than 4 or 5 soldiers attacked me. I had a broken rib.
There's only a small scar left on his cheek from that incident, but the wounds left by the American invasion and its aftermath run deep in this community.
We were hoping that even if the matter ends with the occupation of the Americans, at least there will be a semblance of security. But unfortunately, things only got worse and worse.
Zahi originally hails from the Sunni area of Jurfa Sakhar, 50 miles south of the capital Baghdad. It's part of what used to be called the Triangle of Death, a cauldron of frequent attacks on American forces by armed groups, including Al-Qaeda.
It really was the triangle of death. You left in the morning and you didn't know if you'd come back home.
Zahi was a low-level member of Saddam's Ba'ath Party and initially supported the Sunni insurgency before it was taken over by Al-Qaeda.
In the beginning, there was strong sympathy with the resistance when it wasn't yet Al-Qaeda because they were hitting the Americans. But the Americans had armored vehicles, so the biggest death toll was among the Iraqis.
Both Sunni and Shia civilians were caught in the middle. Further south in the town of Tuareg, we meet Jebel Abdelamir. He used to work as a minibus driver and often took passengers on the dangerous journey through the Triangle of Death.
There were so many victims in this area.
But one incident remains etched in his memory. An American military convoy opened fire on his own family while they were driving down this road.
We were driving very slowly. The American soldier got angry at us. He waved us away, and the one behind him opened fire.
His family sustained only minor injuries, but it was another rude awakening that the so-called liberation wasn't going to simply end decades of brutality and hardship. Tuareg is a Shia town, and many members of Jebel's extended family had opposed the Sunni dictator. Jebel's wife, Suhaila, lost 5 relatives to Saddam's repression. She shows me a picture of her brother, who was arrested and executed in 1989.
Here he is standing in the market with a friend. This was 1 week before he was arrested.
Suhaila initially welcomed the American invasion.
We thought the Americans would free us from Saddam, that finally we'd get our rights, but we haven't seen any benefit.
Regime change happened quickly, but there was no plan, purposefully, for the day after.
The United States and our allies have prevailed.
The Coalition Provisional Authority, the American governing body that took over the country, had little knowledge of Iraq. In a misguided attempt to purge Saddam loyalists, it dismantled the Iraqi army and other state institutions. Jebel served as a soldier in the army and was fired.
The biggest mistake the Americans committed was to dissolve the military and state institutions, because those were the ones who controlled the streets and all matters. Yes, it was a harsh system, but a system is nonetheless a system.
Extremists and insurgents, both Sunni and Shia, filled the security vacuum and mobilized against the occupiers. They soon began turning on one another. After the 2006 bombing of the Shia shrine in Samarra, the country descended into violent sectarian civil war between Sunnis and Shias. Hundreds of thousands were killed. Mixed areas like the town of Musayyab, where Dahi now lives, saw the worst of it.
If people were killed from one side, then people were killed from the other side. Whether you had anything to do with it or not, you had to pay the price.
The sectarian war began to subside in 2008. American troops withdrew in 2011. But the forces that were unleashed in 2003 were not easily subdued. Al-Qaeda morphed into ISIS. And American troops returned in 2014 to take part in the war when the jihadists conquered a third of Iraq's territory. In the Triangle of Death and elsewhere in Iraq, ISIS's brutal reign reignited intercommunal tensions. Three of Dahi's cousins were kidnapped in 2014 and are still missing. He blames Shia armed groups for their disappearance.
They were innocent people who have no relations to politics or religion. They were kidnapped just because they were Sunni.
The repeated cycles of violence caused massive waves of displacement, resulting in enduring demographic changes. Dahi's family fled their 12-acre farm in his original home area of Jurfa Sakhar, located a short drive from here. He hasn't been back since 2006.
If I tried to return to my farm, I don't think I'd come back alive. Entry to the area is forbidden.
Jurfa Sakhar is now controlled by a powerful Shia armed group that mobilized against the American occupation. It later fought ISIS as part of an umbrella of Shia-led paramilitaries that have since been integrated into the state security services. Dahi cannot cross this checkpoint. We stop at a market just a few yards away. Many of the men who work here are also displaced from Jurfa Sakhar. Their fate is part of the series of incidents that can be traced back to the invasion.
This is one of the results of the American invasion. The United States bears the responsibility.
The armed actors who rose up after 2003 later used their military might to consolidate their grip on politics and the economy.
Even after the violence subsided, ordinary Iraqis didn't taste the dividends of democracy. Saddam's repressive regime was replaced with a dysfunctional kleptocracy, and little of Iraq's oil wealth trickled down to the population.
Jebel and Suhaila are equally disappointed with Iraq's ruling elites.
There are huge resources in Iraq, but because of the corrupt elites, the people are not getting their share.
The couple have one daughter, Asma, and five sons, including Mohammed. They struggled to find jobs until the war against ISIS raised the demand for young men. Both Mohammed and another son, Ali, joined the Iraqi army. It was the only chance to find a stable job.
The economy was doing poorly, and I didn't have a high school degree, so there was no other chance but to join the army.
Another war imposed another layer of loss and trauma. Entire busloads of young men were shipped to the front lines in 2014. The pictures of the fallen now line the streets of Tuareg and other cities across Iraq. Mohammed lost five of his colleagues when ISIS attacked their convoy.
Most of my friends have died. We were 31 in my sniper unit. With one explosion, an entire Humvee was taken out.
ISIS was declared defeated in 2017, though sleeper cells continue to destabilize rural communities. It is why some of the Shia paramilitaries say their continued presence in places like Jarfa Sakhar is required. Dahi now lives on a much smaller plot of land he inherited from his late father. He has given up hopes of reclaiming his farm.
The situation will not stabilize. The area was exposed to killing, dispossession, and many other problems.
For now, the guns have fallen silent, but the repeated cycles of violence have irrevocably marked this community. Iraq remains a fractured nation, awash in weapons, and still struggling to find peace. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Simona Faltin, south of Baghdad.
And there is much more about the anniversary of the Iraq invasion online, including insights from foreign affairs correspondent Nick Schifrin about the challenges that young Iraqis are facing 20 years later. That's on our TikTok account.
Since starring in the hit sitcom Fresh Off the Boat, Randall Park has become a familiar face on television and in some of Hollywood's biggest movies. Now, the Korean-American actor can also be found behind the camera. He makes his directorial debut with Shortcomings, which was acquired for distribution earlier this month. I spoke with Park about the film, his long career, and the power of authentic storytelling as part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
It was fitting for Randall Park to help produce his own interview.
Soft sticks.
Now that the actor can add feature film director to his resume. We spoke the day before the world premiere of his directorial debut called Shortcomings at the Sundance Film Festival.
How excited are you to see how audiences react to it?
I'm terrified.
Terrified, that's the word.
Well, it's like, you know, you put so much into something. Everybody involved really recognized how special this project was and really put everything into it.
The dramedy is based on a 2007 graphic novel of the same name by Japanese-American author and cartoonist Adrian Tomine. It tracks the everyday life and romantic travails of Ben Tanaka, a cynical movie theater manager and wannabe filmmaker in the San Francisco Bay Area.
He is highly opinionated, charming, he's funny, but he's also a bit miserable.
15 years ago, then a struggling actor, Park discovered Shortcomings in a bookstore and was immediately pulled in.
At the time, I was like, oh, I would love to play Ben.
What was it about the story that spoke to you?
It felt like a real reflection of my life at that time. It's not like filled with a lot of those common tropes that you see in Asian American stories, you know, whether it be intergenerational conflict or you know, a trip back to the motherland. But this is really just people hanging out, eating at restaurants, arguing, you know, in apartments. That's what it is. And that's the kind of authenticity that excites me the most about it.
Park says writer Adrian Tomine had pitched his screenplay of Shortcomings shortly after the graphic novel was published. There was some interest, but with a caveat.
So 15 years ago, in order to make it palatable to a broader audience, characters would have had to be changed to white.
That's what the industry was saying back then, and this is such a, it's a deeply Asian American story. It makes no sense for that, you know, to be the case, but that's the way the industry was back then.
Hollywood wasn't ready then, but Park played a role in changing the face of the industry.
Happy book day to you. Happy book day to you.
After years of bouncing from role to role, he was cast in a network comedy as Louis Wong, the Taiwanese patriarch in ABC's Fresh Off the Boat. Based on a memoir by celebrity chef, writer, and director Eddie Huang.
Your boy Eddie Wong.
It was the first network sitcom starring an Asian American family in two decades, following Margaret Cho's groundbreaking 1994 show, All American Girl. While critics, including Huang himself, accused Fresh Off the Boat of sanitizing the immigrant experience, it marked a turning point for the Asian American community, as Huang told R. Jeffrey Brown back in 2016.
We needed to get on base. There was not a sitcom with Asians that you could watch anywhere on American television. We didn't have representation. And while a sitcom isn't the end-all be-all of identity and representation in America, it's a big step.
Fresh Off the Boat ran for 6 seasons and turbocharged some cast members' careers. Constance Wu, who played Wong's mother, went on to star in 2018's mega hit Crazy Rich Asians.
Now you really should have told me that you're like Prince William of Asia.
That's ridiculous. Much more of a Harry.
Park has since become a red carpet fixture, juggling a range of roles, co-writing and starring in the Netflix rom-com Always Be My Maybe with Ali Wong.
Yes, yes, very long time. What's up?
And stepping into the blockbuster superhero world with recurring roles in both the DC and Marvel cinematic universes. The years of work proving there was an audience for these stories paid off. Park and Tomine joined forces to pitch Shortcomings the movie and succeeded.
My goal is to just tell a specific story about very specific characters and hope that some people like it.
Just some people?
Or a little more than some.
Despite his many successes, Park says he still sees himself as just another working actor.
Is that from like an early career mindset or just the way you are?
I think it kind of almost as a protective mechanism. Don't celebrate something too much because lows are inevitable and the highs are possible, but the lows are inevitable. That's just life, I guess. And in a way, I think it's made me dead inside. I'm playing, no. But in a way, it has made me very, very much focused on the work.
Park has directed before, including the series finale of Fresh Off the Boat, but Shortcomings, he says, was different.
It was kind of life-changing in a lot of ways. I felt very much in my skin. Acting has always been a source of joy, but this was rewarding in a way that I never felt before with acting.
Starring Justin H. Min, Sherry Cola, and Ali Mackey. The film also features a mostly Asian-American cast.
When I first started, I think there was still this sense of there can only be one. Because if you looked at a show, there was always just one, Not just Asians, but any kind of minority group. And now I feel like just seeing how things have changed and interacting with these young actors, I just feel this sense of real community and camaraderie.
They're not yet dead inside, right?
They're full of life and joy.
And they're part of a project Park hopes will allow stories from the full spectrum of Asian American life to emerge.
When you're traditionally underrepresented and there is a scarcity of narratives about your group, the instinct is, we have to tell the idealized version of ourselves. Mm. We have to be heroes, and those stories need to be told. But I really think that when you're being dehumanized, it's nice to show portrayals that are humanized. And humanized means human, which means complex.
And messy.
Messy, making mistakes, sometimes making the same mistakes over and over again like we all do. That's what I'm most proud about when it comes to this movie. It's very real because that's a real reflection of me,
Join us again here tomorrow night, where we'll have a look at healthcare challenges in rural America. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.